Starship base, I'd like to share these recordings with you.
Welcome back to the Maintainer Podcast, where we highlight the people, projects, and partnerships keeping our Navy ready for whatever comes next. Every repaired system, every completed availability, every late-night troubleshooting call shares one purpose: getting capable warships back to the fleet. But readiness doesn't happen by accident. It takes experienced maintainers, strong leadership, and a commitment to preparing the next generation. Today's episode explores that mission from several different perspectives. We'll hear from Executive Officer Captain Dennis Richardson about what fleet readiness looks like from the command level. We'll sit down with Captain Thomas, the new commanding officer of Sima Norfolk, to discuss how the Navy is rebuilding technical expertise through the return of shore intermediate maintenance activities. And finally, we'll visit one of Marmac's most specialized teams, Code 295, where precision, experience, and teamwork help ensure some of the fleet's most critical combat systems are ready when they're needed most. So settle in, turn it up, and stay tuned. You're listening to the Maintainer Podcast. Before we jump into today's interviews, let's begin with a few words from our commanding officer, Captain Dan Heminger, with the latest command updates from around the waterfront. Over to you, Captain.
Good morning, team. Captain Heminger here, coming to you from the Maintainer Podcast, the forum where we proudly share the impressive talents and commitment that make up Mid-Atlantic Regional Maintenance Center and the greater Norfolk Foundry ecosystem. Before we dive into today's topics, I want to make a public service announcement on behalf of our awesome MRA team who have really put in a lot of time and energy planning this year's command picnic. I'm super excited about this year's picnic as well, since we're teaming with Sima and we'll be having a joint picnic on Friday, the 31st of July. So take a break from the grind and come out with friends and family to enjoy cornhole, bounce houses, water slides, good food, and depending on your aim, the opportunity to subject your CO, XO, or CMC to some cold water. Our PAO team has put together an awesome podcast. You'll be hearing from Captain Megan Thomas, the new CO of the newly reestablished Sima Norfolk, and I'm incredibly proud of Marmac's contribution to this strategic effort as we focus on what the CNO has charged us all with, and that is rebuilding, reforming, and refocusing on what matters: readiness, accountability, and results. We're abandoning the shackles of efficiency in favor of the necessity of effectiveness, and I know you're all eager to continue to partner with Sima so that we can continue to develop our local foundry muscle. On June 3rd, the day after the reestablishment of Sima Norfolk, our mission remains steadfast and unchanged. Marmac will continue to be the engine that generates the readiness that is consumed 24/7, 365 from our operational fleets. Sima Norfolk and Marmac will undoubtedly coexist to maximize this effort now and into the future. We simply can't afford to work within our own maintenance silos. We must approach readiness as a collective working across a maintenance continuum, and our relationships based upon mutual respect and a genuine desire to make things better will make this possible. Over the course of the next year and beyond, we will work closely with Sima Norfolk as they progress towards FOC, or final operating capability. Things like a standalone budget, organizational structure, and future capacity and capability will continue to be refined. We've actually got a packed show today that dives right into all of this. In just a few minutes, you're going to hear a segment from our heavy-hitting executive officer, Captain Richardson, passing down technical knowledge to our junior sailors and civilian technicians is what keeps our edge sharp and preserves our legacy. And XO has a wealth of experience and some great thoughts on how we can all get after this and do it better. After that, I've already told you that we've got a fantastic segment with Captain Thomas, the commanding officer of Sima Norfolk. She'll be discussing what standing up this command looks like from her perspective, and she'll provide us her vision for how Sima will enhance the collective foundry with a focus on sailor training and self-sufficiency and increasing afloat readiness. And finally, we have an excellent segment featuring Dave Hamady from Code 295, our vertical launch system experts. If you aren't familiar with exactly what 295 does, you've got to listen to this episode. On Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, the Mark 41 VLS is the ship's primary battery and ultimate source of combat survivability. Our Atlantic Fleet DDGs and their Mark 41 VLS systems are at the heart of the current fight, and make no mistake, Combat effectiveness depends entirely on how well that system operates when the button is pushed. Dave discusses the amazing complex work his code accomplishes every single day, from the vital system maintenance that keeps our warships lethal, to the critical testing certification and combat systems alignment efforts that our technicians are leading the Enterprise with. All right, team, that's all for me. As always, thank you for your tireless dedication and commitment to ensuring our fleet remains ready. Stay cool out there, and I'm looking forward to catching up with each and every one of you at our command picnic. Captain out.
Fleet readiness is more than just fixing equipment. It's balancing today's operational demands while preparing for tomorrow's mission. It's removing barriers, developing people, and making sure every ship leaves the waterfront ready to answer the nation's call. Public Affairs Specialist Oscar Pope recently sat down with our Executive Officer, Captain Dennis Richardson, to talk about leadership, innovation, and the mindset that keeps Marmac moving forward. Let's take a listen.
Thank you, Jared, for that introduction. Captain Dennis Richardson, ladies and gentlemen. Sir, thank you for being on the show.
No, I appreciate you allowing me to get on here. It's only been 8 months that I've been here.
Right.
You
know,
you promised me I would be able to get on the podcast.
Yeah, we tried to get you in here to talk about your first 100 days, but that didn't work out. But we got you here.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
We're going to get into some topics. And before we get into those topics, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
No, I appreciate that. A little bit about me. Super proud. I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. I am a huge Lions fan.
Okay.
In fact, I'll take any team, you know, out of Michigan. I'm a huge supporter. I like to say Michigan is a sports mecca. Like, we win in every sport.
And I know, debatable.
I know. You go talk about the Lions, but I'm just telling you, we on the rise and we in the conversations. But no, originally from Detroit, Michigan, grew up in the inner city. Graduated from Henry Ford High School and decided I wanted to go in a different direction and join the Navy. Joined the Navy in 1995 as an undesignated seaman. Worked really hard and struck out a deck and chose the rate of damage controlman. Did that for a couple of years, you know, came up through the ranks and then applied for the surface engineering LDO program. I was fortunate enough to get selected and earn my commission. And off I went. So I've been an engineer in LDO for the last 21 years. I'm at my 30-year mark right now. And it's been really rewarding as far as commands I've been at. I've been at least 10 ships, you know, three different shore commands and really good commands. You know, I taught at DCA school for 3 years, probably most rewarding tour that I've ever had, you know, as enlisted. And then as far as for officer, probably the best tour I ever had was Board of Inspection and Survey NSERV. That was a phenomenal tour. And competing, you know, second to none is probably this one right here. I'm having a ball, you know, as the executive officer at Mid-Atlantic Regional Maintenance Center. So it's been really good.
Absolutely. Thank you for your initial enlistment and subsequent commission, sir. Navy has truly gained an asset over the years with your leadership. And we are here at Marmac also grateful that you've made some changes here, some well-needed changes that we've come across here at Marmac. So thank you for your contribution.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
So, you ready? Ready to get into these topics?
I'm ready. Ready, all late, right. Fast, Freddy.
All right. So let's talk about mission and operations.
Okay.
So we know Marmac plays a critical role in fleet readiness. How would you describe Marmac's mission to someone that is outside of the Navy?
No, that's very interesting. And always find myself answering this question when I'm talking to somebody who is not familiar with, you know, what we do at Mid-Atlantic Regional Maintenance Center. But I look at Marmac as the 911 and the pit stop of specifically the Atlantic Fleet. We are primarily responsible for repair, maintaining, and then modernizing, you know, surface ships and making sure that those deployers are ready, you know, to deploy at any given time. So fleet readiness is our primary, you know, mission here. So that's how, you know, describe us as a 911 and pit stop for the Atlantic Fleet.
That's interesting. I never heard of us being the 911.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we got the TSDO take calls all throughout the night. Fleet Tech Assist is always on the call, you know, whenever there's a critical system down, whether there's degradation, you know, in engineering, you know, they're calling the TSDO, they're calling, you know, Marmac to get Fleet Tech Assist or onboard Tech Assist, distance support, you name it. And so I look at us as the 911, the first responders, if you will, for fleet readiness.
Great. That's an awesome way to put it. So we talk about successful maintenance cycle. What does it look like? What does that successful maintenance cycle look like from your perspective?
Yeah, I would tell you, like, that is success is subjective in a sense to where disappointment is driven by, you know, unrealistic expectations. But specifically to your question, I think, you know, success, a successful maintenance cycle to me is like on-time delivery of an asset back to the fleet. Fully certified, you know, with zero safety mishaps in the process, you know, success also means, you know, that the ship's crew is confident, you know, in operating that piece of equipment, you know, that we worked on, that we modernized, and that we returned back to the fleet. So that's what success looks like to me.
And obviously there are issues that may arise in and avail that may not necessarily be or cause the avail to be unsuccessful, meaning we don't feel confident enough that we haven't met certain wickets along the way, but still finish a little bit beyond scheduled time.
Right, right, right.
But those wickets or those issues were resolved. Would that still, you know, qualify as a successful avail?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's why I started off by saying it's subjective. You know, right. If we're looking at it, you know, from a fixed standpoint and not a, you know, a growth standpoint, there's always growth. And there's always the unknown of a maintenance availability. And you don't know what you don't know until you get into it. But, you know, success always looks like when you run into a problem, you have a meeting of the minds, you sit down and you figure out a way to yes. You figure out a way how to remove the barriers and get to the end state. And that end state is to on-time delivery and have an asset ready for the operational commander to be able to utilize the asset in our interest and our protections.
So I guess the key takeaway is making sure that ship gets out, not on time, but most importantly, ready.
Ready, 100%.
Obviously, there's a lot of demands on Marmac. So how does Marmac balance those demands of operational tempo with long-term sustainment and modernization?
Now, that's a really good question. I don't know if I'm going to be able to answer that, but I can give you my perspective, you know, because, again, I think that's subjective as well, just depending on where you're at, you know, in the food chain and, yeah. and what your mission set is. I think we use a rigorous risk management perspective to execute emergency repairs, you know, for today's fight. We have a methodical approach in planning specifically for larger avails to install, you know, those modernizations and the capabilities for tomorrow's fight. So I think that balancing of demand, the demand is always changing based on, you know, America's interests and the mission set in which we're given. So it's constantly changing. But yeah, I think the way we approach our modernization and our repair is based off a risk management base. Specifically, if we can't get a system back up to 100%, like what is the risk associated with that? What capabilities do we lose? What does that asset now represent in terms of risk to the operational commander when we deploy, you know, that ship forward?
When you talk about a risk management, I think that's, people may argue with this, but I think that would be foundational to any balancing of demands. And then going back to that being that 911 entity, if you will, just makes us more flexible to meet various types of demands.
Yeah, 100%.
Next topic we'll talk about is leadership and people. As XO, so you are responsible for leading the diverse workforce of sailors and civilians and contractors. What leadership principles guide you day to day?
Yeah, this is, you know, for me, you know, my primary focus as executive officer, one is to align and support the CEO's guiding principles. My role is really to remove those barriers so our team, the entire Marmac team, whether it's civilians, it's contractors, or it's military personnel, you know, can execute that mission, whether it's technical, professional, or personally, in a safe working environment. So, you know, my job is to align with him, to promote his guiding principles, his standards, and enforce those. And sometimes it's not cute. You know, I am somewhat the enforcer. I maintain good order and discipline. I try to bring consistency, fairness across the board, whether I'm dealing with military, civilians, or our contractors.
Definitely the CEO's right hand takes me back to Game of Thrones, the hand of the king. Definitely the enforcer. I've never met an XO that wasn't an enforcer. So I definitely think that you're executing that role quite well.
I think the one principle, too, really important for enforcing for the CEO that I think is something beyond this tour right here I'll take with me is the one is his first principle, and that's to resist a no because mentality in favor of a yes if mentality. You know, I think that's super important how it's framed. Like, you know, let's not start off with no because. Let's talk about yes, we can if these certain conditions are met. I think that's where that growth mindset kicks in. I think that's where you generate synergy within the team, you know, and I think that's where you figure out how to remove barriers and stuff. So a lot of times, you know, for me as an XO is to put that team together and focus on that. Let's remove the barrier of the no because, and let's figure out the yes if and kind of work through that problem set. So I think that guiding principle is one that I'll take with me for my command tour if I'm fortunate enough to get one.
Absolutely. Even me as a parent, I've adopted that yes if mindset to allow that development for even, you know, our children. Yeah. So thanks for that. Where are we now? Let's go to a moment that you can share where your team overcame a major obstacle.
No, thank you for that question. I appreciate it. I think one of the things is our struggle to retain the technical talent is challenging, right? When you walk around Marmac, there's a lot of gray beards with years and years and years of experience being on the deck plate as once a sailor and now as a, you know, as a civilian or even as a contractor, like trying to retain that talent is a challenge, right? And so it starts with the sailors that we have here today that's in uniform and, you know, making it impressionable onto them about continuing service, pouring into them, developing them, because we'll get a return on our investment, hopefully, if they really believe in the work that we're doing and how important it is. They'll want to continue to serve and cross over once they retire from the military or depart from service. They'll cross over and hopefully come back and we get a return on our investment. So I think that's our biggest challenges. But we are addressing that in a couple of different initiatives that we got, just investing in continuous training. You know, we're doing that with the new CIMA reconstitution, where we're focusing on world-class onboarding and training, giving junior personnel those mission-critical responsibilities and skill sets early and continuing to build on them as they rotate back to the fleet. So I think that'll all dovetail into creating a workforce where we're struggling at to retain that technical talent, you know, in the civilian and the contractor sector that we have here at Marmac.
Thank you for that, sir. Yes, absolutely. With any organization, retaining talent kind of speaks to how the continuity of an organization can kind of thrive through over the years by retaining exceptional skilled workers. I guess that kind of helps us segue into the innovation and the technology piece. So we talk about maintenance and modernization and how it evolves like ever so rapidly. So what new technologies or processes are having the biggest impact on Marmac's work right now?
Oh, I will tell you, there's two things. One, we're in the early stages of playing with AI in terms of seeing where that can benefit us on the planning side, planning maintenance availabilities or ISRAs. So we're really in the early stages of that. I'm really excited about the different models and the different meetings that we took as far as using AI to project, you know, long lead time material, projecting production growth. So that's in the early stages. But where we at right now is really the additive manufacturing, the 3D printing for obsolescent parts that's no longer in the system, trying to scan those and doing a proof of concept to see whether or not those can be used and supplemented for the lack of that supply chain to support some of these critical pieces of equipment. And then you also got the advanced non-destructive testing that we use and to help identify material that's degraded because of its failure. So those three things right there, I think, are super critical. And like I said, yeah, as we get into the early stages of AI, I think that the predictability that AI brings us is going to be super beneficial to ship repair.
Absolutely. AI definitely allows a lot of streamlining of work, taking a lot of guesswork out. You know, AI is really good at finding information from a myriad of sources, and the end user, the sailor or the civilian, can have that at their fingertips in a matter of seconds.
Oh yeah.
So maybe we can work towards a more adequate work towards the avail in terms of now we have information sooner rather than later. Hopefully that'll drive towards getting the avail out on time, ready.
That predictable maintenance model is critical, right, to the planning piece, and then the execution piece, obviously, more importantly, and making those adjustments along the way. So, you know, I think in the next year or so, I think we'll be further along than where we at, and we'll see it in actual application to where we got some real data in real time to where we can extract and make some adjustments or whatnot. But I'm excited for that.
So Marmax supports ships across the Atlantic fleet, right? What does, and there's a huge coordination piece here, but what does that coordination look like between Marmax and other ship commands?
That's a really good question. I think the coordination between Marmax and I like to consider us our partners on the waterfront, you know, the war fighters, right? We're in direct support of them. It's like supporting the supported. That coordination is really key. And during my 8 months here, it's been really good, like just integrating our project team with Ship Force early in the planning phase to ensure alignment, to build the rapports, you know, with Ship Force, build, you know who's who in the zoo, building those good relationships. And that way you can always figure out how to get through any scheduling conflicts, you know, any technical risks that we may be inadvertently and unintentionally transferring to the ship. We can have those conversations and kind of work through them without personality and emotions getting involved. So that early integration, creating that synergy, building that relationship is super important. And so far, I think we've done a really good job on both ends, from Ship Force, also to Marmax as well. So I've been on the waterfront for a long time, specifically over here, you know, like I said, 10 ships. And Captain Heminger has been on the waterfront, been around a lot. So the relationships are there and they continue to grow and continue to build and continue to expand. So I think that helps a lot.
You want to talk about any challenges that you have working with the ships?
Yeah, I think, I won't say they're challenges. I think it's kind of par for course. Like, we all want the same thing and we're running different routes. We're going to the same point. What we all want is to increase readiness. We want to make the ship safe and whole in order for them to get underway and execute the mission. So it's just two different perspectives. There's a Ship Force perspective, and then there's a customer perspective, if you will, and Ship Force. And then there's a business side to Marmax. Some of the levers that I think Ship Force think we have, we really don't have. And so bridging that gap, sharing information, transparent, open dialogue and conversations, removing emotions is always the challenge. I would say the human emotions is the challenge, being able to separate those and get to the crevices of it, because no one is intentionally trying to fail. No one's planning for failure. You know what I mean? We're experiencing failure on both sides, whether it's in a planning process, it's in an execution process, it's in a procurement process of parts, tools, materials, or whatnot to execute the job. So once we recognize those shortfalls, put the difference to a side, and then find a way to yes, is what we've been doing. So again, I think the challenge is always removing the emotions. It's that human interaction.
Easier said than done for most of us. Yeah. But definitely that's part of the team aspect and getting to that goal as one team in one fight. So we talk about the collaboration of the military civilian communities. How do you foster the collaboration across those communities?
Yeah, that's really tough. I'm learning that in real time as I'm here. So I'm not an expert at all. I like to think we get better each day as we build in those relationships. But it's building a unified project team. The unity in the project team is super important and is critical to the success of whatever project that we own. So whenever there's an opportunity for sailors, you know, and civilians to work side by side, to be in the fight, turning riches on complex systems, there's some magic that happens. The mutual respect organically happens. The collaboration happens naturally. You know, you build a relationship, and then that's all fruit. That's all goodness to the end state of building a cohesive, coherent project team that's focused on the actual end state and what the mission is.
Absolutely. So let's hear your personal perspective about what drew you to maintenance and engineering in the Navy.
Yeah, I enjoy engineering because I think it's hard. Every day is different. You know, I am fundamentally an operator. I enjoy being on ships, smaller teams. It's like the man in the arena. You know, I like being the man in the arena. And I love building teams. I love being around young sailors. I like to be around characters. You know what I mean? Like, I like to joke. I like to enjoy it. But then I also want to get the job done. So it's that whole process of being of what being an engineer, you know, means. It's not necessarily just fixing stuff. It's the relationships that you build while you're fixing stuff, right. You know, while you're trying to figure that out. So every day is different, you know what I mean? And the challenge is to get through the day. I always say every decision can be a potentially career ending decision. Weighing the risk, collaborating with your team and making the best decision humanly possible keeps me coming back every day to do it. So.
What do you find the most rewarding as being the XO here at Marmot?
Yeah, I think for here is you can impact change like every single day. Ultimately, I'm not the CEO, so Captain Hemminger gets the last word. But there's a certain amount of trust and respect that he's given me. I understand his guiding principles. I understand most of the time where his head's at, what he's thinking. But I think at heart, as professionals, as men, I think as human beings, we align really well ethically, morally, and professionally. So having the ability to help, not hurt sailors and officers or enlisted and officers reach their goals, man, it's the most rewarding job that you can possibly have. And so being an XO, I'm loving it. Like, it's good.
I could tell you love it, you know, just seeing you around the deck plate, interacting with the individuals around the deck plate. You can definitely tell that you love what you do.
I need that human interaction.
Right.
Like, I got to have it. Like, I'm walking around like I was talking to you about that terrible truck you bought. Like,
right.
You know, I really want to talk to you about that kind of offline. Like, I think you should have an F-150, but
sure. It'll never happen. But.
But it's those conversations, you know, it's those conversations that I need on a consistent basis where I walk around and see what's going on with your family, tell you what's going on with my family, you know, while we're still doing the job. So I enjoy that.
Absolutely. And we definitely appreciate you having that personable aspect about you. Just to let our listeners know that, just to be clear, I personally will never buy a Ford F-150. Never in this lifetime. But I'm glad you enjoy yours, but it won't happen over here. Let's continue to talk about how human are you. And we'll kind of leave off here and, you know, leave the audience with who you are and what you're all about. And the last question I want to, you know, kind of just ask is, if you weren't in the Navy, what do you think you'd be doing right now? Besides working on your F-150.
I honestly think I would be somewhere in the community. Like, I would probably want to teach. I prefer to be in an inner city school, somewhere where I grew up at and how I came, and mentoring the next generation somehow. Like, I'm deeply invested and passionate about that. So I think I would be in some type of school district teaching. And it wouldn't matter the subjects. I would just need to have that interaction with our youth to make sure I'm pouring into that next generation. I think that's what I'd be doing.
Absolutely. Giving back to the community is also huge and commendable. Any final words you want to leave with our listeners?
Yeah. People, product, process. Right. That's my focus. Right. It's people, product, process. I always focus on the people first. Get to know the people. Understand what the people need. Understand what the people don't want. And then I focus on making sure that they understand the process of what we do, and specifically ship maintenance. And there's a lot of other things we do, but giving them solid processes that's repeatable and predictable, the product will always come out.
Right.
The product is delivering readiness, making sure we provide the operational commanders with assets that's ready to deploy in all facets of the job. So if I focus on the people, give them solid processes, the product will always come out the way we intended. So that's what I focus on. That's what I will leave you with.
Yes, sir. Sounds like the secret sauce. Thank you, XO, for joining us here.
Appreciate
Tell the listeners what your favorite podcast is.
My favorite podcast is the Maintainer Podcast at Mid-Atlantic Regional Maintenance Center.
One theme stood out throughout that conversation. Readiness begins with people. As technology evolves and the fleet continues to modernize, developing skilled maintainers has become just as important as maintaining the ships themselves. Captain Thomas, the new commanding officer of Sima Norfolk, joins Oscar Pope to discuss the return of shore intermediate maintenance activities, why they're being reestablished, and how they're helping prepare sailors to become not only operators, but expert maintainers. Here's Oscar's conversation with Sima Norfolk Commanding Officer, Captain Megan Thomas.
Let me know when you're ready.
Let's get at it.
Let's just dive right into it. Captain Thomas, thank you for joining us today on the Maintainer Podcast.
Absolutely. It is my pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for taking the time to help us educate everybody on what Sima is and will do in the future.
Yep, absolutely. So we definitely have a lot to cover here across different segments from the why to the what's next. But before we get started, give us a brief introduction about you. Where'd you grow up? How'd you get here?
Okay, great. I am originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Grew up there my entire life. My dad was in the Navy, but back from 1950 to 1952. So a little bit had changed by the time that I had come around and considered service. But ultimately, I was fortunate enough to be able to get an NROTC scholarship, went to Penn State, got my commission out of there back in 1997, and was brought on as a SWO with the opportunity to go on to nuclear training. So my career, which now is 28 plus years in service, has been primarily on destroyers and carriers. And I also had the opportunity to be able to command both a destroyer and a cruiser. Most recently, I served as the force material officer at Surflant, which really provided a great foundation, I think, for me to be able to see holistically how the material readiness of our warships is trending. It gave me some insights and built some relationships with the larger maintenance community. So as the discussion about reestablishing SIMA, Shore Intermediate Maintenance Activities, came up, it was certainly something that excited me. SIMAs existed when I first joined the Navy, but then went away during my first set of sea tours. So it's exciting to be able to see this force multiplier come back kind of in a new version to be able to restore some of that self-sufficiency and material readiness for our warships going forward.
Thank you for that. And it's quite the resume. And this journey of getting SIMA reestablished, it's definitely not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, no, in my opinion, this has given me an opportunity to really be a capstone of my career, to be able to help give back so much to an organization that I think is driving us in the right direction of where we want to go. The world has certainly changed from the time when SIMAs were disestablished. Of course, the decisions made back then were all rooted in the truths that existed at that time. But now the world changes, as it often does, and I think this is the right time and place for us to be able to bring back SIMA.
Yes, absolutely. So let's get into the why. Why reestablish SIMA in the first place?
So I think there's a lot of reasons that go into that. For one, we have seen that ships need to get back to the self-sufficiency. While we had some periods of time during COVID where we saw this increased self-sufficiency because there wasn't any reach back that really could be, at least not on board, kind of technical assistance, we saw ships that were able to do things that they hadn't done in a long time. But like many things, we have snapback when that happens. And I think we need to double down in being able to build self-sufficiency. So if we are going to get into future battles, that the high probability of being limited to have onboard tech assists exists. And so we have to be able to have sailors that can operate and fix their equipment at sea. And that is kind of a fundamental part of us bringing back SIMAs, is trying to build that sailor technical expertise that allows for the self-sufficiency going forward. And of course, with everything that we're seeing, technology is moving. And we need to make sure that our sailors have both the skills to be able to adapt. They need to understand the theory behind things so that they can then be able to make repairs. So even if they haven't seen that exact repair done before or that exact problem done before, we've given them the fundamental knowledge to be able to figure figure it out and move forward. I also think that obviously the material readiness of our warships is a critical foundational item for us to be able to fight and win at sea. We're seeing some of our ships, especially here on the East Coast, are a little bit older than the average fleet. They run into a bit more challenges as they age. And so more and more important that we are reinvesting in our people so that we can correct those items so we can get through long lead time material challenges and other things through hopefully more preemptive or proactive maintenance than really always being reactive.
Thank you for that. You're definitely echoing Admiral Kilby's sentiments in that this is a strategic investment. And he also states that, you know, some of Bill Sailor's technical expertise and competency to perform intermediate level maintenance. So for listeners, we've got contractors, military and civilian listeners who'll be listening to this. Can you explain to them exactly what CIMA does?
Sure. And I think it's an evolving process, but we have two primary missions. One will be to increase enlisted technical expertise, which really is what CNO provided as his top priority for this initiative. And so we are doing that kind of training and learning through repair actions, specifically intermediate level maintenance repair. And then the second item is the improving the combat readiness of our surface ships. So that is, again, through the intermediate level maintenance repair. By combining those two elements together, we're able to help build back readiness overall, and that will help us in whatever future fights we have.
Definitely the mix of sailors and civilian and the contractor workforce. You know, the sailors learning from seasoned experts while still owning the work, it speaks volumes of CIMA sailors.
Yes. And I'll say this is a partnership. So intermediate level maintenance cannot be the only type of maintenance we have. So there is critical depot work that's going to continue to happen that we need those shipyards to be able to function and concentrate on the truly depot level repairs so that they can work that timely and in conjunction with the other items that we need to do in order to extend life cycle maintenance. So RMCs are absolutely a partner with CIMAs to be able to move this initiative forward in that vein. And then at the organizational level, Ships Force has to do their part too. We have to give them, we, the big Navy, need to be able to provide them the tools, material, and experience for them to be able to do the repairs that are within their capability to be able to do. Together is how we achieve being able to get ships out of maintenance availabilities on time, get ships to be able to reach their expected service life and sometimes beyond. And for us to be able to do maintenance at the right time. So a lot of the challenges that we have are being able to integrate that maintenance. Well, if CIMA can come in and do their maintenance at times that keep it clear from the depot when they need to do theirs, we're creating a more streamlined effect that has less complexity and provides us a better opportunity for us to deliver warships when we need them to and for them to be able to meet their operational requirements when those come up.
Absolutely. The old saying, teamwork makes the dream work. So let's talk about sailor self-sufficiency and their technical expertise. Would you say that a sailor self-sufficiency is one of the biggest goals?
Yes, but it's going to be a marathon vice a sprint at this point. So what we're hoping to do is build both the self-sufficiency of the sailors that are assigned to CIMA. So they're going to come in, they're going to do work on real equipment. We're also going to have some training aids that will enable them to be able to get to more of the practical application of the theory that they have learned in school. That will help build them as they return to sea and help infuse that into our warships. But we're also helping and hoping to be able to improve self-sufficiency through us going on board the ships and doing our repairs. So CIMA Norfolk does a fairly high number of jobs on the ships. So we can provide training really here and now to the sailors that are assigned to the warship. They can work alongside our teams, be able to understand it more, or We can even have sailors on board ships come back to Sima and do work in the shops, kind of over the shoulder work, as we call it, that will enable them to be able to better understand and support their own self-sufficiency. So I like to refer to it as a ripple effect that starts in the middle with Sima and then extends out. And hoping through those force multiplication kind of events, we can build self-sufficiency across the entire waterfront. And of course, that's being done in all the fleet concentration areas where we're working to bring back Sima. Right now, Simas exist in Norfolk and San Diego. Mayport's going to come online here on September 1st. And then additional efforts are being made beyond that.
So this sounds like this is how sailors will gain their confidence to be competent maintainers, not just operators.
100%. And again, there were decisions made 20 plus years ago where we were going to focus sailors on being operators and not maintainers. We see the need in order for them to be both now. And I think that's appropriate that we're building this foundry. CNO's one of his core tenets here is the foundry. And we consider ourselves kind of at the center point of where he wants to build that skill set.
Right. So let's address the, you know, some solutions to, you know, gaps in sailor proficiency. So you mentioned gaps in hands-on experience. How does Sima help close those?
So one of the key ways that we think we're going to address these solutions is through shop rotations at Sima. So again, this is a little bit different than Sima 1.0. We're calling this Sima 2.0, in which sailors will get diverse experience across their rate that will make them a more well-rounded sailor. So in the past, they have been assigned to a specific area or duty, and they stayed there for the entirety of their three-year tour. It made them really good in that one specific skill set. But unfortunately, not all of those had a return to sea value when they went back to a ship. So specifically, an example would be a machinist mate who may be dedicated to the flex hose shop for three straight years. Well, they've become an absolute asset in that flex hose shop. But in terms of their future on a ship, being able to cover the wide array of requirements and skills that a machinist might be able to do, that was somewhat limited. And that's not to poke at anything of how this process has worked in the past. I think this has just given us a new look on how we could be training our sailors. And so through shop rotations, they'll get experience in ACNR. They'll get experience in a valve shop. They'll work in the pump shop. They'll have a wide array of experiences. And then we're also helping to get experience in troubleshooting. So how we're going to merge fleet tech assist and specifically the military that are assigned to fleet tech assist responsibilities, how we can marry those two sides that have previously kind of been stovepiped, how we can pull them together to be able to share that level of knowledge from senior technicians with repair technicians and help build a better maintainer.
Right. It sounds like, I think you briefly described one of the training labs that was named in honor of Captain Bob Butler. Tell us a little bit more about that training lab.
Yeah, no, thanks for the opportunity to do that. So this is kind of a vision here in Sima, Norfolk, and we've started to build this out where right off of Main Street, you have a training lab that has the ability for sailors to get hands-on equipment, really dive into the equipment, understand how it works, be able to work and get experience in test equipment, to be able to better understand that without any concern of potential damage to critical components, or really even being able to try out a repair before it goes back to the ship. And it's available all the time, right? They don't have to wait until a ship with a specific opportunity to be able to support our training is available. That's available to them at all times. So we want to use that training lab and further develop it. So it's part of the onboarding process for new sailors assigned to Sima. It's available for people that have been at Sima for a number of years and maybe are just looking to build a certain skill set. And it's available to the waterfront that if they want to come and they want to get their hands on these pieces of equipment, they can. So Captain Bob Butler has been absolutely critical as a former Sima Norfolk CO himself and a three-time Sima CO. He's been critical to the effort of bringing back Simas and happy to be able to name this training lab in his honor for a reflection of the support and knowledge he has provided to us to be able to bring this back.
Absolutely. This training lab will definitely offer an opportunity for sailors to build that technical depth and preserving the legacy of sailor-led maintenance.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about fleet readiness and surge capability. Tell us a little bit about how CIMA affects that.
Yeah, it's really the gold for CIMA is through the enlisted personnel that are assigned to CIMA, and we're at about 1,000 sailors right now, a far cry from the 2,500 that used to exist previously when CIMA was around here, but 1,000 sailors who can respond and be a surge force to enable a ship to be able to be repaired quickly, correctly, and back out to sea to meet the requirements. So we've seen this in a couple different examples already where we've had a team, and that is a civilian and sailor team. So certainly it is important. Civilians are a critical element of what we're able to do. But we've seen that in being able to get a ship back out to sea after they had a lube oil leak off of their attached lube oil pump for an MRG. We've seen that right now we're going through some rapid swaps of equipment that will enable a ship to be able to get to sea with all the critical components that they need while we work the repairs on the other equipment. It just is something where you have the ability to use CIMA as a 24/7 kind of response team to be able to make these repairs more timely. And from a perspective of other maintenance organizations, there's a few more steps in the process. We're still going to go through all the planning. We're still going through all the QA processes. But through the active duty force, we're able to respond more rapidly.
Definitely. That sounds like a readiness multiplier, if I've ever heard one. It sounds like it's also going to reduce that downtime and prevent schedule delays.
So that is the goal. We are trying to be able to help have both predictability in the work that we want to do, but we acknowledge, for instance, as a ship is getting ready for light off assessment, as they're finishing up in a CNO avail, there could be equipment that doesn't operate the way it operated prior to the CNO avail. And so we can be that surge force that comes in and allows ships to be able to meet their milestones, then enable that follow-on commitments to be able to be there. So this is going to be a teaming effort, like we talked about before, to be able to identify where CIMA can come in and help fix those items. And we want to be flexible enough to be able to surge in those instances while still maintaining a steady strain on the other requirements from CMAVs and CNO availabilities to keep those on track.
Right. Definitely a core part or a core reason why CIMAs were established in the first place. So how does CIMA support the waterfront? What does this mean for the ships home ported in Norfolk?
So this means that we are partners with them, that we 100% see us as you have already said, a readiness multiplier. So whether or not they need support in being able to complete jobs that just because of their operational requirements or their manning situation, they haven't been able to get to. So we can supplement that. We can help provide training if they have gaps in areas where, because of some junior technicians, they haven't been exposed to things. We can build that. We want to be able to help and work with the naval surface groups as they identify trends on the waterfront that we can then step in and help close those gaps, whether or not it's through repair or it's through training.
Modernization and advanced capabilities. Talk to us about how it's not just a reactivation, but a modernization in that vein.
So I think we're trying to understand where the needs are. And so as ships have modernized over the years, there's a need for us to also modernize with it because there could be better, faster ways for us to be able to repair equipment. So probably the one that comes to mind the most is in advanced manufacturing. So the bigger, broader terminology that includes subtractive manufacturing, additive manufacturing, or what most people understand as 3D printing. So there is a lot that we can be doing that we can improve upon, and we're leaning forward on that. So we have the ability for advanced manufacturing, but we know that we need to grow this. The Navy needs to grow this. Certainly the surface community needs to grow this in order to be responsive. Because as ships modernize, then there is different equipment and our parts support needs to keep pace with us. But sometimes through a number of reasons, that may not be available on the shelf. And so being able to use advanced manufacturing for quick response, being able to help with redundancy for our warships, we need to be able to lean forward here and capitalize on that technology. And looking forward to seeing where this is able to take us in the next year or two.
That's right. Keep up or get beat up.
Yes.
So let's talk about the a sailor's expectations when they report to CIMA.
Yeah.
What can they expect when they arrive at CIMA?
So first of all, what we're going to really hammer home is the idea of our two core elements, right, is developing sailors and delivering readiness. So that's our motto. But that gets 100% to the idea of increasing that sailor technical expertise and improving combat readiness of our warships. So that is the mission that they are a part of. So if they're excited about being able to learn more about their skills, get their hands on their equipment, learn more about their rate, and they also want to be able to have the job satisfaction of knowing that they are supporting the warfighter, this is the best place to be. So as they step on board, they're going to go through a pretty formal, robust onboarding process. It can take anywhere from 30 to 60 days, depending upon what their prior experience is. But we're going to bring them in, get them through all the normal in-doc processing. But then we're going to take it one step further, and we're going to ensure that they have all the skills they need to be an immediate contributor to the shop that they get assigned to. So through assessments, we're going to find out what their individual training plan should look like. We're going to develop that shop rotation plan like we discussed a little bit earlier to be able to get them that experience. They'll have the vision of what we're trying to achieve. And then we're going to follow them throughout their three-year tour to monitor their training, their development, so that on the back end, they have an entire process where they understand what they have accomplished and their gaining command can see what they completed during their time at CIMA. So they know the skill sets that they're inheriting with this sailor. And ultimately, what we're trying to build back is that ship who is getting a sailor, and they look at their history and fleet temps and they say, oh, awesome, this person served at CIMA. I'm in good shape because I have that. So that's the spirit that we're trying to build. It is shore duty still, so nobody should be concerned at all that, man, I'm going to be working as hard on shore duty as I am on a ship. But like I said, we do have some elements where we're trying to build that surge capability. There's a lot of critical management that is going to happen at the individual level and at the ship level in order for us to make sure that we're meeting these missions.
Yes, they'll definitely be a part of a command with a strong heritage. And one that has supported the fleet for decades and is now returning stronger than ever. So the bigger picture, paint the picture for a new sailor, help them understand what it all means.
It's really all about the warfighter. It's about enabling our warships and our sailors to be able to go across the ocean, be able to go beyond the horizon and fight and win when the Navy and the nation calls. We want them to both have the confidence in their equipment and the confidence in their skills to be able to meet that mission. And I think that's absolutely something that we are driving home every single day. Every week when I talk to CIMA, I reiterate who our near-term deployers are, what they're doing. And I think it's absolutely a critical element as we get that feedback from the waterfront about what difference those sailors are making, that we're sharing that, because that's really what gives a whole lot of confidence in what we're bringing back here so we can help get people excited so that the next generation of CIMA sailors, the people that we want to come here, they get excited about getting orders here because they know that they can make a difference for themselves. They can make a difference for the ships and then ultimately for our nation and what we need to do.
So what's next for CIMA?
We are learning every single day about where we need to pivot. So there's process improvement is an incredible, important part of what we are trying to do. We are trying to identify where the gaps in capability or capacity are so that we can help drive towards that as we move forward with some of the expansion of CIMA. So we are looking to build the number of sailors, but we want to make sure that we're building them in the right place and in the right way that makes a difference. We want to make sure that who we're bringing into CIMA have that mindset of what we envision for CIMA to be and have a desire to both develop themselves and deliver that readiness for the waterfront. So it's a whole lot of communication that is going on right now, helping us understand where we need to improve support to the waterfront, helping us to be able to communicate with the naval surface groups for them to create this feedback loop for us of where we could potentially build in the capabilities and the capacity to be able to deliver. It's talking with the RMCs about identifying those challenge points for us to know whether or not we can step in. And it's about working with industry, again, for more partnering that enables the mission to be able to be accomplished.
So the recruitment pitch, if you had to pitch recruitment right now, what would you say?
I'd say, come to CIMA Norfolk if you are excited about learning more about your technical rate, about building your professional and personal resume, and you have a vested interest in helping improve combat readiness of our warships. This is 100% the place you should be. And the way that the Navy is driving technical expertise, both from MCPON and CNO, their focus points are very clearly in this vein. There is no better place to be right now than at CIMA.
Hey, Captain, thank you for joining us and leading this critical command. To our listeners, CIMA Norfolk is back, and it's bringing with it a renewed focus on sailor skill, fleet readiness, and technical excellence. Because this foundry makes the fleet
fit to fight.
Building tomorrow's maintainers is one side of the equation. The other is learning from the experts already setting the standard today. Few teams better represent that standard than Code 295, Marmec's Vertical Launch Systems and Combat Systems Alignment Branch. This team tackles some of the fleet's most technically demanding work, often under tight timelines and high operational pressure. Public Affairs Specialist Harrison Cox spoke with Acting Branch Head Dave Hamadi to learn what makes Code 295 one of the most trusted technical teams at Marmec and beyond.
All right. Hello, everyone. I am Harrison Cox, and I am back with Dave Hamadi. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Yeah, so today we're going to be talking about Code 295, which Dave is the acting branch head for. And Dave, I'm just curious, could you just talk to us about your role as the acting branch head for Code 295? And what does Code 295 really do?
Yeah, so to answer the first question, as acting branch manager, I handle all aspects of the code, both financially, personnel, and technical experience. I direct workflows and make sure time is updated and accurate. So all the boring manager duties, but also very important. Very thankful to be given this opportunity to be in an acting role for this code, because this code is very unique. We have two sides of this code. We have a VLS daytime side and a CSA or combat systems alignment nighttime side. For the VLS side, we are encompassed with 2 degrees of certifications. So everyone in my code is certified by the program office to be able to work on VLS. Without that certification, we cannot do our jobs. So everyone maintains their annual certification, and there's 2 degrees of that. We have the system maintenance technician, or SMT for short. They are essentially SMEs, but they don't have the same level of authority as the second level, which is test director or TD. They are direct representatives of the program office. So they have a higher degree of responsibility and knowledge base and technical experience that allows them to maintain that level of certification. So we are very involved with the VLS, vertical launching system side of the house. On the CSA side, you have a similar certification. You have senior aligners and junior aligners. We have two senior aligners and about to have a second junior aligner. And the CSA team, they work at nights and they do all the alignment data for every class ship on the waterfront, including Coast Guard ships. So they are constantly busy. They're constantly on the move, helping ships every night. And they're very unique because their work goes into the central data system of the ship. It's called an adaptation data, but we don't need to get into that. And without that data and without it being accurate, the ship essentially can't function. It can't navigate, drive, it can't defend itself. So Code 295 in both halves of its aspect is very critical to ship safety, sailor safety, and critical missions.
Most definitely. And I know that we were talking right before we started recording that Code 295 is incredibly busy. I think you said it was 21 people in total in the code?
Yes, with military and contractors and civilians all combined.
Wow. And, you know, of course, as you said, the VLS system is very critical, very important for all of our crewed fleet. So on a day-to-day basis, what does a Mark 41 VLS system maintenance technician, what do they do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so an SMT does FTA support, onboard technical assist. With VLS, we also do assessments with TISRAs, and we also do CMO avails. So we are there with the ship during their avail periods doing what's called launcher recertification testing. Without this testing, the ships can't be recertified by the program office or the ICA to take on missiles and go forth and complete their mission. So they do a lot of day in, day out troubleshooting, contractor management, because we have contracts in place to be able to do overhaul work. They're very involved because we are also certified naval basic paint inspectors. So we're involved with launchers resurfacings, which is a critical coating. So we do our own QA for that process. So we're heavily involved in avail processes to ensure ships get the best attention possible and get fixed the first time. So that way when they leave the yards, they're all ready to go to complete their missions.
And I know that talking to you, you were saying that Code 295 is highly sought after. And our very own commanding officer, Captain Heminger, recently referred to Code 295 as the go-to team on the East Coast, noting that you are routinely requested by other RMCs for support. What makes your team so unique and highly sought after?
So part of that uniqueness is our certifications, both on the VLS and CSA side. Second is our technical experience. Mm-hmm. On the VLS side, we have over 140 years of experience throughout the entire technicians from, you know, retired chiefs to engineers. So our technical knowledge is very detailed and thorough. But more importantly, speaking more towards the CSA side, the CSA team is one of the only teams in the country that can do what they do. So they are constantly on the move, whether supporting overseas or at other RMCs, mainly on the East Coast, as well as FDRMC over in Rota. They are constantly being asked to do alignments because not everybody has the technical experience, because our most senior technical aligner has been doing this for 40 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He knows his knowledge base of alignments.
Pretty experienced.
Absolutely. So that team works so well together that they're able to get alignments done in very short amount of times. Yeah. And we have the equipment to be able to do so many different faceted alignments instead of just doing full CSAs. We can do piecemeals and still maintain alignments pierside.
Wow. Okay. So it sounds like Code 295 has a very critical job for a critical piece of equipment on the ship. So for the listeners who might not be on the deck plates every day, can you explain the critical importance of the vertical launch systems for the crewed as fleet?
Absolutely. So VLS is essentially main battery for destroyers and cruisers. We defend the battle group, and we are critical to completing the ship's missions. On the other side, the CSA side, I think I mentioned it earlier, the adaptation data that is collected from the CSA team goes to the ship's computer systems. And without that data, the ship can't navigate. It can't travel, it can't defend itself. So all weapon systems depend on that data. So without it and without it being accurate, we don't have a warship.
Right. Speaking from the experience that you were talking about for your crew, can you just speak about the resilience and the dedication of the maintainers within Code 295?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the team is very resilient. They're very dedicated to their job. They take pride in what they do. The team is focused on getting problems solved the first time and on time. We are accustomed to late night phone calls, especially when we get called for ship support up at Yorktown Weapon Station to go up there and support the VLS onloads. We support almost every single onload, if not every onload, that comes through Yorktown.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
We get requests to help them with their onloading processes, as well as to solve last minute faults before these ships go on deployment. For example, on the VLS side, right? We have critical components that makes VLS work. There's a panel, and this is right before, towards the beginning of Epic Fury. One of those critical panels had to be swapped out because a component within it could not be replaced. It was stuck. And it was broken, so we couldn't fix it any other way. So we had to replace this panel, and it was announced to us 1 week prior to the deployment.
Oh, man.
Now, usually through the supply system and standard acquisition processes, that takes about a month to change out. We had a week. My team focused on coordinating with another ship, coordinating with crane operations, coordinating with the ISCA to basically ACAN one of these panels from another ship that was going into the yards and was able to replace it in 1 day.
Wow.
So it took a couple of days to get all the coordination together, but normally it takes about 3 days to actually do the swap out. They did it in a morning.
That's pretty good. That's insane, actually.
Yeah, so they were... And we were able to get that ship out for its Epic Fury deployment. On the CSA side, similar task, we were requested to do a alignment on the 4C whip on a ship down in Mayport, also 1 week prior to their Epic Fury deployment. And we had to get down there very quickly to do the alignment, which the team was able to do again in one night, and get the data together, reported it to the ISCA so they can then do their side and get the adaptation together and incorporated it into the ship's computer system. So that way that ship could leave on time for their deployment. So we are always dedicated to helping the fleet, and we are actively coordinating jobs with maintenance teams. We're just heavily involved, and that's why we are so successful in completing our missions and our jobs.
Yeah, wow. So it sounds like Code 295 had a direct impact on Operation Epic Fury, just from all the amazing work that you were just telling me about. So that's awesome. I'm sure you're proud of all of them and a lot of everything that you've done. So looking back on the work that your team has completed, what are you most proud of? And what message do you have for the men and women of Code 295?
I'm proud of their hard work and dedication to the fleet. I want to thank them for maintaining the high tempo pace required to support the fleet during Epic Fury, as well as their ability to support the fleet in such great standards and details on a regular basis. And it's because of this dedication and pride that they take in their jobs that we were awarded our code's first ever branch of the month from MARMAC, which is a fantastic award. And it feels great to be recognized by the command. And I know my team is definitely thankful for that. And I'm also thankful that I'm given the opportunity to work with them and support them so they can go out and support the fleet.
Code 295 being on time and on target, especially with all the amazing work that you have done for the Mark 41 VLS system. And in support with Operation Epic Fury, I think you guys have done an amazing job. And of course, Branch of the Month, that's a huge achievement. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And I just want to say, Dave, thanks so much for coming in for this interview. And it's awesome to see all the amazing work that you and your team have done.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you.
From leadership to training to technical excellence on the deck plates, today's conversations all point to the same idea. Fleet readiness is built one sailor, one repair, and one team at a time. Whether it's mentoring the next generation, solving complex engineering challenges, or responding when the fleet needs help most, every member of Team Marmac plays a role in keeping our nation's Navy ready. And that is a wrap on another episode of the Maintainer Podcast. A sincere thank you to Captain Richardson, Captain Thomas, Dave Hamadi, and everyone who helped make today's conversations possible. A quick update on a prior guest of the show, Marmac's own Dylan Caves took second place in the Atlantic Fleet Rifle Reserve Duty category of the 2026 Navy Marksmanship Competition earlier this year. We interviewed Dylan in episode 9 of the podcast, and if you haven't heard it, it's definitely worth a listen. Congratulations, Dylan. Best of luck to you in future competitions. As always, thank you for listening. Before we go, I'll pass it over to a few of our shipmates to help close us out.
This is MM3 Pons.
This is MM2 Brown.
This is Trevor Poole. I'm a mechanical engineer in the Innovation Lab.
The Maintainer Podcast is produced by the Marmac Public Affairs Office.
Follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn by searching
Mid-Atlantic Regional Maintenance Center.
You can also check out the Marmac News and Event page on SharePoint.
Stay current with everything happening around the command.
If you have an idea for a future episode,
or if your team is doing something the command needs to hear about,
drop us a line at Public Affairs.
We'd love to hear from you.
We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, keep building readiness, keep supporting the fleet, and keep up the great work. Fair winds and following seas. I'm Jared Patch, and you've been listening to the Maintainer Podcast.